This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This drive to publish starts so early in us, way before we're writing, because in America, it's all that forward thrust to success and accomplishment and whether or not you're going to be graded for it. And if you're not going to be graded for it, what's the point?
Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, Isaac Butler.
And I'm your other host, June Thomas.
June, it is so lovely to see you on this hot May afternoon, getting the air conditioning turned on for the first time. Let me ask, whose voice was that we heard at the top of the show?
Hot May afternoon, Isaac. It is 54 degrees where I am. But to answer your question, I am wonderful, thank you. Especially because the voice we just heard belongs to writer Anne Lamott, who has a new book out called Somehow Thoughts on Love.
Amazing. I remember fondly assigning her legendary essay, Shitty First Drafts, to my students every year I taught writing, which gave them the permission to just relax and start working on the thing so that you can later make it better. Tell me, are there any extra tidbits for our Slate Plus listeners today?
You know there are, Isaac. Slate Plus members will learn which craft writing books Anne Lamott recommends. I also asked about her favorite books about love, the topic of her new book, and I was both surprised and moved by her answer.
Well, if you are a member of Slate Plus, you can be surprised and moved when you hear that segment, which is waiting for you at the end of our regular show. If you're not a member of Slate Plus, don't you want to be surprised and moved on a regular basis? Well, now you can by going to slate.com/workingplus, signing up today. You'll get full access behind the paywall on slate.com, bonus episodes of shows like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, bonus segments on shows like ours, and you will get to rest easy at night knowing that you are supporting what we do right here on Working. Go to slate.com/workingplus to sign up. All right, that's enough pitching for me. Now let's listen in on June's conversation with writer Anne Lamott.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on credit worthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com. Anne Lamott, welcome to Working. I'm excited to learn more about your creative process.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
So your new book, Somehow Thoughts on Love, is your 20th, which is wonderful. Has writing for publication become easier or harder the more you've done it?
Well, I know now that certain things will be true of everything I write, whether it's a book or an article, a column or something like that. Before probably the first 10 books, I would feel despair when it wasn't going well, when I would start something new. I'd feel like, oh, the well has run dry, or talk about beating a dead horse. And then I'd always push through because I knew that you had to somehow finish it and get to a first draft. And then what the piece was about would be revealed and you could make it a lot better. But now I don't snag on that so much. I know that it won't go well. I know it'll be terrible. I know my first drafts will be overlong and over detailed and a little purple and a little, there'll be a message. And so I have to go take out the message and take out the descriptions and the details. I know it will sort out at some point now, way earlier than I used to.
It's funny that you talk about shitty first drafts because of the many things that you're known for. I mean, that is the thing that people kind of, I think, well, as Anne Lamott says, it's something you're very famous for. And so it's interesting that that really is something that you're very aware of as you're writing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And also the bird by bird idea that like that you take very small pieces of it. No one knows what they're doing with a whole 2,000 word piece or a 50,000 word book. In Bird by Bird, I talked about the 1-inch picture frame that I can show you mine, even though this is just audio, which is proof that I have one, because you think no matter how many books you've written that you should know what you're doing, and you don't have to, no one does. And but all you need to know is what you're going to do that day. And that's pretty much whatever part of the whole you can see through about a 1-inch picture frame.
You certainly also go for the big topics, you know, love, faith, self-expression. Where did this most recent book begin? Something tells me it wasn't with the thought, I would like to write a book about love, but maybe it was.
No, it absolutely wasn't. I'm 70 soon, and I've started to really experience that we're all on borrowed time. On one, was one aspect, and another aspect was that I'm just so sad and worried about the future that my son and his child, who's 15, almost 15 now, face with this catastrophic climate change and the stupidity and ignorance and lack of doing anything about it. And I started wanting to leave them a handbook for when I'm gone on everything that has ever worked in my past, when there have been very dark times, really scary periods of life, like say the 8 years of Dick Cheney or even COVID or periods of time after I had lost somebody where I felt like a, you know, anvil had dropped on my being and my heart. And so I started writing these stories and essays for them about what had always worked and what will almost certainly work no matter what the future holds. And over again, they somehow had to do with love. They had to do with certain realms of love, you know, family love, which is so fraught.
Yeah.
And community love, what Martin Luther King called the beloved community, or the love of nature, and even the very difficult experience of self-love, of coming to that, or of coming to a self-acceptance that that you pretty much did the best and you screwed up right and left, and everybody does, and everybody screwed up, and the really, really deep feeling of friendliness I've developed that actually older age has given me. And so I started writing about all those things, and lo and behold, there wasn't anything that didn't in somewhere or another have to do with love. Love as an energy, love as a decision, love as an action, love as a reaction, love is the work we're here to do.
As I was reading the book, I was aware that there were times when you were kind of telling stories on yourself that you didn't have to tell. You know, I wouldn't have known that you, you know, sort of said something that you later regretted to a friend, or that, you know.
Yeah.
And yet now I have a better sense that maybe you tell those stories to help others find forgiveness or find self-love.
Well, yes, and it helps me have love and forgiveness for myself. And the stories that I tell that you would say are on myself, I know are universal. I don't tell them till I absolutely know that anyone I tell them to is going to have a variation on the same story of saying stuff that you just kick yourself for years and that other people kick you for, and that you can't seem to ever be forgiven for. And I tell, you know, there's a beautiful line by the Persian mystic Rumi where he said, through love, all pain will turn to medicine. And I was healed by the medicine of the women's movement and the love that the women in our groups and gatherings and in our literary world, the gift, the literary gifts that the women in the movement gave me. I was 16 when the first issue of Ms. Magazine came out. And so, and through that love, all my stuff, you know, my self-loathing that I was so different and looked so different and was bullied so heartlessly as a child for my strange hair and my differentness. And through people sharing their own stories, it really did all turn to medicine. And I was given it so freely. And so I give it away in the hopes that it will be medicine for others.
Yeah. You have written a lot, both in the past and in this book, about faith. And in your books, you often mention St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church in Marin City, California, which you attend. I am not a person of faith, but I must admit, although that might not be the perfect word, that I often found your discussion of faith and what I would describe as Christian charity really moving. How do you approach writing about your spiritual feelings, knowing that many of your readers will be of different faiths or no faith?
A lot of my readers are people that just have run screaming for their lives from Catholicism and from fundamentalism. And I've often written, I'm a very, very left-wing activist at the same time that I'm a Sunday school teacher. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people have found that because I don't have a heavy position on any of it, that they can tiptoe back to what they might have had as a child, which was a curiosity about it. Mm-hmm. But I think that this thing that you would identify as Christian charity, I really think that's how we come. I wrote a book on mercy several books ago. I forgot what it was called. Might have been Hallelujah anyway, but it might not have been. At any rate, it was about this understanding I had, or a feeling I had, that children who can be little beasts, definitely, also have this huge reservoir of generosity and mercy in their hearts. Like if you've had kids or nieces and nephews, you make them lunches for preschool and kindergarten and elementary school that you want them to eat, right? Mm-hmm. That's why you made the lunch. And then they give them away because someone else forgot theirs, or someone else got bullied and got their lunch stolen, and kids give them away. But at some point, probably around first grade, that natural streak of generosity and mercy in us, you gets put away in a drawer. First of all, it's not being graded for. And second of all, it's not going to save you on the blacktop from the people of power, who are almost inevitably the boys, the bigger boys. And so you put it away. And in this book, I talked about, as a way of helping save the world from impending doom, that we become people more actively and intentionally of mercy. And that meant opening the drawer and fishing it back out, you know? And so that's my basic religious position, and it's not something you need to protect yourself against, you know, or or recoil as from hot flame because it's too Christian.
Yeah, yeah. One of the experiences you describe in Somehow really stuck with me, and that was the time when your friend Tim, for whom you are a spiritual mentor, became upset by something you said to him as you were trying to offer advice as to how to deal with his negative response to a person in the community. His response really disturbed you, it upset you. And the reason this stuck with me was that you describe seeking healing by writing down, quote, what terrible fears and feelings I was having about who I am deep down. That act of doing that felt really appealing to me, but ultimately it didn't seem to help resolve the situation you were seeking help with. I'd love for you to tell that story and what you learned from it.
Well, I have a man, a very, very old friend, younger than I, and I'm close to he and his wife, and I'm sort of a spiritual mentor of sorts for him. And he was in a very clenched, miserable, prickly situation with one of his dearest friends, who I don't get. I don't get why she's one of his dearest friends, because I think she's awful. But so he was had been really hurt by her. And we were talking on my couch, and I accidentally just started trashing her and saying, well, she's, you know, jealous of your long-term marriage, and she's this and she's that, and she's very superficial and surface-oriented. And I thought it was just all true and that it was helpful. My help is usually not helpful. But anyway, later that day, he called me and said, I don't want you to be my mentor anymore. And I don't want to turn out like you. And it was just piercing because, you know, a lot of us, I'm sure you're fine, June, but a lot of us, if we get any criticism from somebody we trust, we think that they alone are seeing into our souls. And that everybody else is either just sort of flummoxed by our personalities or our persona.
Our charm.
Our charm. We've seduced and charmed them into not noticing that we're, you know, not noticing our inner Donald Trump. So it was devastating. And I had no effective mental defense against it. It just pierced me. Oh, I don't want to turn out like you. And I just went into the rabbit hole. And I did some of the tools that I wrote about in the piece. One of them was to, you know, write down these terrible fears about I have about myself, because we really are as sick as our secrets, and the secrets we try to keep from ourselves run us. And my husband, who's written a book called Better Days on the Inner Critic, said, oh, this is just your inner critic on your shoulder in the guise of Tim telling you what you've been secretly believing for, you know, almost 70 years now. And it kind of made it a little tiny bit better. But as you know from the story, it was just so painful. And so I did what you mentioned. I did some writing, and I did, you know, I've been clean and sober for 37 years, and I've got some tools in my rusty old toolbox. And one of them is to do some writing, to do a scribbly inventory of what I'm so afraid of, what I'm sure that they're right about. Mm. And it, you know, it took a few days. It, you know, God and life, neither of them seem to have magic wands. And I think it's a terrible system. And if I were God's West Coast representative, I would have a wand. And if you wanted to feel better about something like that, and you were genuinely contrite, I would just tap you on the head. But that's not the system currently in place.
Yeah.
You know, Gabriel Garcia Marquez said something 1,000 years ago that I love. He said, we all have our public life, our private life, and our secret life. And so when you go into that secret place is when the going gets a little rough, but where the very juicy stuff that can lead to a much more expansive life resides. Mm-hmm. And so I hate it when it's happening. And then when I've come through the other side, you know, through that dark pipe with my elbows completely scraped up and bloody, I think I wouldn't have missed that for the world, because what I got back was a little bit of affection for my, you know, very mixed grill self.
You know, it is, as you say, it's too bad that there isn't this just like, no, I didn't need to do all that. All I needed to do was X, Y, Z. But there's
no
X, Y, Z. You just got to go through it. It's kind of too bad. That's the answer. But I'm glad that you told it to us so that, you know, maybe we can try not to, you know, hope for that shortcut.
Yeah, I wish there was too. I mean, I just hate it that there isn't. I completely resent it that there's not the X, Y, Z. But what there is are the two or three trusted friends and that you can tell anything to. And, you know, when I first got sober in 1986, someone said to me, the willingness comes from the pain, you know, and the willingness to do the deep dive into these old patterns that are very self-destructive or that keep us really small and scared, the willingness to take a look at those and see what we can let go of comes from the pain. I mean, if I'm feeling good, and I'm coasting along and I'm getting lots of nice fixes and hits from the media or from my friends or my communities, I'm not going to look at the fact that the aspects of me that are kind of a con man or a seductress or a, you know, not really even listening to what you're saying, just planning how I'm going to respond and whatnot. But when I make myself crazy enough, I know to stop. I know, like as a writer, and what I tell my writing students is that it all begins with just stopping the mindless bullshit, stopping the, you know, living unconsciously. And with writing, you stop not writing. You know, most of my students that come to my talks, my son has a writing community called awritingroom.com, and there are 500 people there. And I would say 200 of them want to be writers, have paid money to learn some skills and craft, but they haven't actually started writing. And that's the fly in the ointment is the writing, because it's hard. Yeah. But so I say to them, you got to stop not writing. That's where we're going to start, is with you just stop not writing.
We'll be back with more of June's conversation with Anne Lamott after this.
What's the best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day in everyday situations. But if that's not on the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. I've used apps in the past to learn new languages, but when I came across Babbel, I wondered if it could help me refresh my knowledge of a language I once spoke well, but was now a little bit or quite a lot rusty. I have to say, I was impressed. The advanced lessons were really useful, tips and idioms that can help with in-depth conversations on topics that I can actually imagine chatting about. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel is designed by real people for real conversations, and the tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. What's more, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time deal for working listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for working listeners, at babbel.com/working. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/working, spelled BABBEL.com/working. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, listeners, Isaac Butler here. Not going to take up too much of your time. Just wanted to say, if you are enjoying this episode, why don't you make sure you follow us wherever you get your podcasts. If you already do that and you're wondering what else you can do, well, you can rate us, you can review us, you can click a little check mark or whatever it is that your podcast app of choice asks you to do with the podcasts that you like. Those help us rise to the top of the swampy, mysterious algorithms that govern everyone's culture digestion habits, and we'd be really grateful. So thank you so much. And now back to June's conversation with writer Anne Lamott.
I do want to talk about writing and craft advice, since you are, you know, one of the most influential people in that realm. But I guess I just want to sort of pause to say that there's this wonderful immediacy to your writing. I mean, in your nonfiction work, it often has the quality of, you feel, you know, as you're reading, you feel like you're eavesdropping on your conversations with friends and loved ones. You know, the incident with Tim that you just described, like, I felt like I was living that with you as you were kind of sharing that story. But you write about real people in your life. Obviously, they know you're a writer, but how do you sort of let them know that you would like to, or that you're going to use their insights or their lives in your published work?
Well, I change a lot of details, first of all, not just for reasons of libel and slander, but because I want to protect people's privacy. A lot of this is other people's stories to tell, but, you know, luckily not all of my friends are writers, so I can steal it all. But, you know, I run stuff by people. I say, I want to write about this, and I'll change the details. No one will know that it was you. And I just, what I want to write about is the, in the case of Tim's story, the devastation to my sense of self and self-esteem. And I changed a number of the biographical details of all three people in that story. And then in that way, I could tell the truth of it, that it happened pretty much the way I said, and that I came through it almost exactly the way I said. So I've always, since Sam was about 10, he's almost 35 now, I've been running stories by him that I wanted to publish. And there were things he said, I don't want you to publish that. But I'm so protective of his privacy too. Yeah. But then he's told stories. He has a website or whatever you'd call it, called hellohumans.co, and he's told lots of stories, and I look at him, I go, oh yeah, fine, it happened. You know, it's really rough. He was like me, an alcoholic and addict. He's got 13 years clean and sober, but we had some horrible times, years from about 14 till whatever that would make him, 22, where he was out of control. And so we had tears and we had anger and we had awful times. And I didn't write about the stuff that was really intimate and primitive. I wrote about the stuff that was helpful to other parents going through this and other growing and grown children who had to deal with parents like me who believed we had an answer to their problems and had good ideas to help them find their way out of their hole and continue on their hero's journey. So I'm very, very careful with people's intimate stories. And, you know, you got to find a balance because I've said before, you know, you own everything that ever happened to you. And if people wanted you to write more warmly about them, they should have behaved better. And the stuff that happened is yours. And you do have to think about libel. And you do have to think about belonging to your family if you have, if you're still a part of your family, and but you need to find the balance. I mean, that's where fiction comes in, right?
Right.
Yeah. And I have discovered when writing about my own family and closest friends that if I change people's height and hair color, they don't really recognize themselves.
Good tip. At a number of points in this book and also Bird by Bird, you talk about the importance of and benefits of community. Here on Working, we often get questions from listeners who are introverts, yet know that they would benefit from, for example, finding a writer's group or other kinds of, you know, community groups for other aspects of their life, but they don't find it easy to share with strangers. What would you say to introverts or people who are shy or socially anxious about strategies they could use to overcome their reluctance to be part of a creative community?
Well, I think that's why the internet is so great. I mean, it's been so destructive for us in so many ways. It's so addictive and it's so toxic and whatnot. But I'd love to plug a writingroom.com again because it's anonymous. It's anonymous. It's first name. And it's people at various stages of writing, brand new writers who haven't actually started and people that have been published because we all have the same stuff, you know, the same obstacles, the same egos, the same self-doubt, the same kind of pretzelized fear that we're going to be exposed as not being that intelligent or gifted or whatever. So, the best thing for me is to have other people to run it by. So what they're doing at a writing room is having these communities of people who have just started a memoir, the community of people who have nearly finished one and don't know what to do, people who are worried about libel, people who think they might want to take what they've been writing for 20 years and turn it into a novel or a screenplay instead of trying, you know. And so if you can, it's like how I stayed sober is by talking and hanging out with other sober people and helping newcomers and sharing what it's like for me and listening to what it was like for them. And little by little, there's a community of trusted people who just get you and who can say, you know, I was there the other day. I was going to throw away this book, this novel I've been working on for 3 years, but I didn't because I remembered that I could make a commitment to the characters and not the book. And little by little, I started helping each character become who they really were instead of who I was trying to get them to be. Or they'd say, people will never say, what? Well, that's ridiculous. Where's your gumption? You know, don't give up. They won't say that. They'll say, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's really hard. And it's not, and writing is not easy. And no one cares if you write. So you'd better.
Right.
And so in that community, and it doesn't have to be, I mean, some lots of these communities besides a writing room and their internet, you can have a video or not. You don't need to see who you're talking to. You can have a community that has made a commitment that every 2 weeks you need to have turned in 6 new pages, finished pages, and you need to have gotten them to the other members before the gathering, and because they're going to critique them for you. And you trust them because a lot of people have gone to writing workshops and just been devastated by the harshness of the critique of the students. But at community of writers in Tahoe. It used to be called the Squaw Valley Community of Writers. The position that is given to all of the students who are going to be critiquing each other's work is that you approach each piece of work as something that's already been accepted by a magazine. And the work of the other 15 people is to bring it up to the highest quality it can be, and not just burnish the surface, but to really help with suggestions. 90% of the time, anyone critiquing anything will suggest that you've gone on a little bit too long, and that the best possible ending is 3 pages before you end up, you know, stuff like that. So,
yeah.
You know, that's what people in a writing room are doing. It's like they're not, it's not like a writing workshop where it's so competitive and people feel really desperate and that it's a zero sum game. And if somebody else is applauded at all, it means there'll be less for them. So,
yeah.
I can understand why an introvert or a shy person would feel scared to death, especially if they've ever tried and had a bad experience with a group or a writing workshop. Now, I really believe in junior colleges. I think junior colleges are the only reason most communities work at all. And there are workshops there. And the people there are your towns, they're your neighbors. You know, and the teachers have always either been there forever or just started. But in any case, they understand that when you're handing something over for others to read, you're handing over the very best you can do. And it's your inside self. It's your heart or your soul,
yeah,
your spirit,
yeah,
or your best writerly efforts. And you don't need someone to say, "You have got to be kidding me."
Right.
Really?
No. Yeah.
Really?
It's interesting that you've mentioned there, like this, it's kind of come up a couple of times as we've been talking, that there's writing and then there's publishing or kind of wanting to be published. And, you know, I think in Bird by Bird, you talk about how many of your students are more intent on publishing than writing. You said something similar earlier. Where do you think that focus comes from, and how can people, I don't know if it's a matter of overcoming it or just kind of really realize what it is that writing is, what it means to want to write.
I mean, this drive to publish starts so early in us, way before we're writing, because in America, it's all that forward thrust to success and accomplishment and whether or not you're going to be graded for it. And if you're not going to be graded for it, what's the point? Like my son, Sam, was and is really brilliant. He's a creative. He's a visionary. He's an artist. And they didn't grade for that when he was in school. Mm-hmm. He was good at math, but things just didn't come easily to him. And so, of course, it thwarted him. And that happens for a lot of the people that I know, because they were artists and creatives, and they had this stuff percolating inside of them, and they were paying attention. A lot of people become artists, of course, had really scary childhoods.
Yeah.
And they, you know, Henry James says a writer is someone on whom nothing is lost, but a child in a scary household in a scary bad marriage is paying very careful attention, so you're not going to be ambushed by your dad's moods or by your mother's collapse or whatever. And so you have these stories, and of course you want to be graded for them, and you want to be published, because we're told from an early age that the respect that we seek, that is so lacking for most of us, is out there, and that we can track it down and chase it down and achieve it. And a lot of Bird by Bird is sharing with people, it's not out there. It's an inside job, horribly. And being published is really, really exciting. But your family is somehow going to find a way to make you feel bad about it, you know, because you're not going to, there's 250,000 general interest books and novels and nonfiction published every year. Your book has 2 weeks in the bookshelf, if it gets to a bookshelf in a bookstore, to make it. And it your first one isn't going, or your second, third, fourth might not. And then there's the flukes, of course, and that those sort of keep you going. And so the publishing almost every time makes people feel worse about themselves than they felt while they were trying to get published, because it's so painful to have worked for so many years, and then this last year before publication of working with your editor and bringing it up to the highest level, and the copy editor and the whole thing, and the people there just at the house just giving you so much affirmation, and you get out there, you may not get any reviews. Almost no one is reviewing anymore. You know, I can count on one hand the newspapers that still have book review sections, Chronicle, Times, Post, I'm not sure who else. Everybody is scrambling for those very, very few spots of being noticed. And it just makes all of your uncooked stuff that we talked about earlier, your ambitiousness, your striving, your hustle, your self-promotion, it, that has to be called forth. I have to call it forth for my 20th book. I have to call it forth. I'm participating in it. And and it just leaves you feeling kind of sad and like a little kid who had this dream and it's not quite happening that way. But the writing will fulfill a lot of what you've always dreamt of. The habit, the debt of honor of the writing by pre-arrangement with yourself at the same time, 5 days a week. And then the community of people who are so proud of you because you've come so far from your first effort 6 months ago. Oh my God, you can't get from where you were to where you are now. And they like your stuff. They like your voice. You know, they like the occasional silliness, which your family doesn't like, or they like that you do the very, very deep dive into the really scary, sad side of things, which again, your family doesn't like. And they're encouraging you, they're midwifing you. And that's where the payoff is. And you stick with that. And some of the people in any writing community or any writing workshop are going to get published. Mm. But if it's not you, the life of the writer is the very best possible life I can think of. It's like having a calling to the monastery, you know, and to become a person. It's a vocation, a person who has a lifelong commitment to reading poetry, because that those are our teachers, are the poets. Mm-hmm. And that life is so profound and challenging. And the payoff is, I think, what we've all longed for, which is a sense of expressing ourselves, of finding out who we are, of finding a connection to other people who have these same longings and gifts that we have, who are supporting us, who are making us do a little bit better than we want to do, that we think it's finished. And they say, you know, I don't know. I don't think the beginning works. I think it starts, it kind of takes off midway through page two. And that first page and a half is just clearing your throat. And you know, my reaction to that kind of criticism, maybe from my husband or best friend, is, well, I'm not going to show you my work anymore because you're an asshole and you don't understand good writing. And my second response is, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. You know, and so to have that kind of communion, that kind of trust, and that kind of ability to rely on people to affirm you and help you be better is a great life. A great life.
Anne Lamott, thank you so much for joining us on Working. This has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, June.
When June and I come back, we'll talk about pantsing and planning, the ethics of memoir, and the importance of community. June, that was a great talk filled with Lamott's signature blend of self-revelation and craft advice. I want to start, though, with a point of disagreement I have long had with her work, which is sort of this thing that she talked about while talking about the bird-by-bird idea, that you don't know what something is when you start. You make the first piece, it inspires the next, and so on and so forth until eventually you've figured it out. I think that's valid. I think there's a very specific kind of writing that this is especially true of, personal essays, and depending on what kind of writer you are, fiction. But for almost everything I write, and I'm going to guess for most things that you write, I do actually know on a big picture level what the thing is. I've worked it out in advance. I've pitched it or I've proposed it. The trick for me is breaking that big thing down into my version of the bird, or what Stanislavski called the bit, so that it is then manageable. And then within those, of course, there's room for discovery, right? But I am not actually stumbling around in the dark. I'm curious about your thoughts on this as someone who is definitely more of a planner than a pantser.
Well, Isaac, I want to just push back a little bit on your pushback.
Ooh, I felt that in my sternum.
I know, right? Right. As I was preparing for that interview, I went back to the book, Bird by Bird, and I realized that I had forgotten the origins of the title's story. She talks about how her 10-year-old brother had had an assignment to write a book report about birds that he had had 3 months to write. And the night before it was due, he had nothing. And their father, who was himself a writer, quote, sat down beside him, put his arm around my brother's shoulder and said, "Bird by bird, buddy, just take it bird by bird." So for me, that story isn't only about taking small steps to find the overall shape of a piece. It's also about focusing on the very next step so that you can avoid being overwhelmed by the vastness of a task. You're absolutely right that this is an approach you can use if you're pantsing a personal essay or a piece of fiction. That is to say, flying by the seat of your pants and figuring out what the story is going to be step by step as you are writing. But I think even if you have a very clear sense of the overall shape of what you're writing, as you've described, unless it's something very short and discreet and easily self-contained, going bird by bird can still be a really useful way of knowing what you're going to do on a day-to-day basis. What's the next step? When you go to your desk tomorrow morning, which bird will you be describing? And to put it in my beloved nerdy productivity language rather than in the language of art or creativity, in that world, they say when you've got big projects or lots of projects or just a lot of to-dos, you should write down your MITs every morning, your most important tasks for the day, so that you know what to tackle first. And it's the same thing, and it just feels very practical to me. Do you disagree?
I don't disagree with you at all. I totally agree. I mean, I think that, you know, you got to break it down into the small pieces and work your way back up. I'm just saying that most of the time when I and most of the writers I know are doing that, we actually do understand the thing we're making on some level. You know, like we have an idea of where we're headed. It is not true that we're just groping around. Not only because then HR would really bring the hammer down on us. I loved your discussion about community and how the internet can be a tool for introverts to get the kind of community they might be lacking IRL. I am not an introvert. I don't understand them, but I think that's a very useful piece of advice. One thing she briefly alluded to that I've been reading a lot about lately is the consciousness raising movement within women's liberation, communities that were dedicated to opening each other's eyes about the ways that patriarchy shapes our daily lives. Now, at the worst, like any other group of people, these communities could be coercive, right? But at their best, they truly change the way people see their lives. The closest we come today is like the montage at the end of Barbie. I'm curious, because of your new book, about what other kinds of community we may have lost that could be helpful for us as artists and human beings today.
Oh, Isaac, you have no idea how overjoyed I am to hear that you've been reading and thinking about consciousness raising groups. I was never in a CR group, but I've also read a lot about their importance in the early days of the women's liberation movement, where groups of women would get together in a room and share stories from their lives. It was apparently immensely useful in helping women gain clarity and see patterns of discrimination, and in many cases, decide to make huge changes in their lives. It's a really fascinating period in history, and I would love to know why it just kind of stopped. Like, it just ended. It was everywhere and then it just disappeared. But that is not what you asked about. As you say, Isaac, in my new book, A Place of Our Own, Six Spaces That Shape Queer Women's Culture, out May 28th, it's about different places where women met and mingled and shared ideas and found friends and lovers and often got so mad that they became activists. And I would say that the thing doing research made me wistful about was just the idea of hanging out. You know, not to say that people don't hang out at all anymore, like humans haven't become robots, but everyone needs to hustle so much these days just to make ends meet that we do it a lot less than we used to, I think, across the board. I know that's a really, like, you know, generalized statement, but I think it's true. In the days before welfare reform, before the recent waves of consolidation and corporate cruelty, before the productivity demands that came from personal computers of always being reachable because of our phones, like, people didn't work so much. It's not that humans were lazy or unmotivated, but work was a smaller part of life than it is today. And in the 70s and 80s, it was easier for people to choose to work part-time so that they could spend time on creative work or setting up a feminist bookstore or trying to open a place for people to hang out where there was less focus on booze than in bars. And, you know, spending time on those projects involved sacrifice. They earned less money, which is always a sacrifice. But it could be tremendously generative and rewarding. And I think of people I spoke with who described how conversations they had while they were, for example, in the dugout of a softball game led them to gather at the martial arts dojo where many of them trained to plan protests about bad things that happened while they were out on the town. So, yeah, hanging out was about having fun, but it was also about sharing ideas and having time to experiment. And I really miss that, don't you?
Yeah, of course I do. You know, I was thinking about this because I was just back home in D.C. And I was thinking about the this is a less political thing, but the coffee shop moment, kind of immortalized by Friends, right? Of kind of the mid-90s to the mid-aughts, which now people go to coffee shops, they just work all the time. But they were a not focused on alcohol kind of alternative to bars. And for me, because that was the, I didn't drink during most of that time, you know, partially because I was in high school. for some of it, you know, my friends and I would gather at coffee shops. That was what we did. They were a place where you could hang out and talk and everything like that. And now that just doesn't exist. You know, like for Park Slope people, they'll make you nostalgic for the tea lounge. Remember the tea lounge?
Yes.
You
yes,
know, like yes, that just isn't a thing anymore, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's awful.
Lamotte is, and I don't mean this derogatively, this is sometimes used that way, I don't mean it that way, but she is a serial memoirist, right? She writes about her life in book after book after book. She's been writing about her personal life and thus inevitably the lives of those around her for at least as long as I have been an adult. I remember reading her parenting column in Salon, for example. And one thing she wrote a lot about during that period was her son. And she would get a lot of pushback on the site from people who felt it was totally inappropriate for her to be writing personal details about her son as he entered adolescence. And indeed, in this episode, when she talked about his struggles with recovery, I was like, should you be talking about this? Like, is he okay with that? Really? You all spoke a bit about how she manages the complicated slalom of autobiography in which you want to tell the truth, but it's not like everyone in your life signed a release that says they're willing to have their personal details spilled all over the internet.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about your thoughts on this. I have realized over the years we've been doing this that even though you don't write autobiographical work very often, you do not mention your partner's name on air. I don't tend to say my wife's name or my child's name on this podcast. And you have certainly edited lots of autobiographical work in which you've had to navigate this sort of stuff. So I'm just curious how you are thinking about this these days.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it a lot because as the publication date of my book nears, I wonder about putting myself out there because every single chapter contains stories of what these places mean to me. And for the most part, I stick to my own experiences rather than those of the people I was in relationships with at the time, I was friends with, or who shared those places with me. And I can't really claim that that was, you know, really planned out and intentional. It was mostly intuitive. Part of it is that I'm wary of projecting my experience onto others. You know, I know how I felt walking down Commercial Street in Provincetown, but since we didn't narrate our feelings out loud, I don't know for sure what the folks I walked with were thinking. But certainly when it comes to my partner, I think a big part of it is that she is quite shy and private, and I know that she wouldn't want her business being put out into the world. It's fine for me to overshare because there's nothing I can do about it. It's just the way I am. But I don't feel like it's my place to blab about her. Are similar considerations at play with you? Is that why you have your restraint?
Yeah, I think about this all the time because, you know, my grad school MFA thesis was a memoir project about my family. And it was on submission and it did one round of submission and didn't get picked up. And then I actually put it in a drawer. And I'm very glad now that I did that. only because I think I'm a better writer now than I was then, but also because I actually don't want everything that's in there out in the world. And I don't want to meet people and have them know all this stuff about me and my parents and my siblings and everything like that.
Yeah.
And I've thought about this a lot. I have become someone who uses the first person pronoun less and less in my writing, and I've become more private in a lot of ways. So for example, when Gabe Roth stepped away from Mom and Dad Are Fighting, I had been a guest host several times. That's probably a job I could have gone out for. I don't know that I would have gotten it, but I probably would have at least gotten an interview, right? And I just realized, I was like, I didn't want to go out for it because I did not want to be talking about my daughter every week on it. It just didn't feel appropriate to me. I'm not saying it's inappropriate to do, but just inappropriate for us. And it's something I think about with this next book, because writing about the culture wars of the 80s and 90s actually does overlap with me a little bit. I was living in DC at that time. I was, you know, a kid marching in the gay rights movement during that time. My mom did have connections to some of the sources that I'm talking to because of her work in the arts. And so currently I still don't appear in it ever. But there's little pockets where I could, and I'm sort of debating what to do about that, you know? At the same time, I think what you've just mentioned in talking about your next book and yourself, what this brings up for me is that, of course, all writing is autobiography, right?
Yeah.
You know, even if you did not include your own personal reflection of those spaces, why'd you choose to write on this subject in those spaces? Because you have an intimacy in with them and they're important to you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. We should come back to talking about how you've decided how to kind of represent yourself and if you appear, because I think that would be an interesting thing to check in on as you keep working on your next book.
Yes. Well, you know, in a year or two, when it comes out, we'll do that.
All right.
That's all the time we have for this week's episode. Before I let you go, I'm just going to say, if you enjoyed this episode, please follow wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't signed up for Slate Plus yet, go to slate.com/workingplus and sign up today.
Thank you to our guest, Anne Lamott, and to our producer, Cameron Drews, who rescues us from all our shitty first drafts. We'll be back next week for Isaac's conversation with Tracy Ann Campbell, the frontwoman and chief songwriter of Camera Obscura. Until then, get back to work.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.